Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the Academic Life Channel here on New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Dana Malone. Today, we'll be talking to Dr. Lisa Nunn about her book, 33 Simple Strategies for Faculty, a week-by-week resource for teaching first-year and first-generation students. Lisa, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much, Dana. It's wonderful to be here.
We're excited to have you back about and talking about your other book. Lisa, I wonder if you could begin by telling us a bit about yourself.
Sure. I'm Lisa Nunn. I am a professor of sociology at the University of San Diego in the sociology department. That's kind of my formal professional world. I'm also currently the director for our Center for Educational Excellence, which is our pedagogical development center on campus. But of course, I'm not always working, and my professional life isn't my whole life. I'm also a California native. My family live nearby, and I spend a lot of time with my nephews and my sister and my mom and stepdad. And what else about me? Let's see. I like to hike and backpack, and I really love to travel. And I'm just thrilled that we are starting to be able to travel again freely. So I am looking forward to a new, like, open doors to the world here coming up.
Yes, I think we all are. We were just talking before we taped about how kind of just, in the last few weeks, as things are opening up, the social schedule has just, you know, kind of blown up.
Yeah.
So that's exciting. It is exciting to start thinking about travel and planes, and, you know, going places. I'm with you on that. If you would, maybe tell us a bit about what inspired you to write this book, 33 Simple Strategies for Faculty.
I never actually intended to write this book. This book was not part of the project that I had in mind. We already did an interview on the book that was the idea, mm-hmm. College Belonging. And so mm-hmm. I had this research project going on college belonging and interviewing first-year students in their very first semester in college. And I'm interested in belonging. And so some aspect of that, you know, at the time I wasn't sure what shape or form that was going to take, but some aspect of belonging at college is about feeling good in your classes and feeling like I can do this, right? Like I belong in college. I'm smart enough to be here. I'm competent enough to be here. And so I had all these questions for students about, you know, how it feels to be in the classroom for them. And, you know, we know that not every student shows up at the doors of college equally prepared for college academics. So I was really curious, you know, students who come from K through 12 experiences that, you know, weren't as glamorous or as well-funded or as, you know, sparkly, shiny academic performance of the schools as some of their counterparts, right? Students who come from rather mediocre K through 12 schooling experiences, how do they feel? What does that feel like to be in class, sitting next to people who you think, or it becomes obvious that they're a lot better prepared than you are. So I'm asking students all these questions like, tell me about your favorite class. What's that professor doing in there that's working for you? Tell me about your least favorite class. What's that professor doing that isn't working for you? And I just got all these incredible details from students. And they're telling me about things their professors are doing that are just wonderful. And so I'm taking notes on the side, right? We're having our interview. And afterward, I've got like a notepad going with all of these great things that I want to start doing in my classes that, you know, came through these stories from student interviews. And also all of these things they were telling me about their least favorite professors that I realized some of them, I do those things. And it had never occurred to me that me doing X, Y, or Z in front of the room or having this kind of assignment or this kind of criteria for my grading would land so badly on some of my students. Like, I just had no idea. And so I also was keeping a running list of things to never do again. And I found that really useful. And I, you know, shared it with some of my colleagues. And we have a special program for first year students on my campus. And they asked me to put together like a weekly email blast, like, okay, give us a tip each week. Or maybe I came up with that, but they were on board. I don't remember how it started, but the book, before it was a book, was a weekly email blast to all the people who teach in this special first year program on my campus. And I wasn't going to do anything more with it than that, actually, but a friend of mine from graduate school, we did a writing retreat together, Stephanie Chan over at Biola. She really encouraged me this one weekend on a writing retreat that we had organized to just make it something that I could share with other campuses, that I could share with other people and, you know, have it be on this little email. So, boy, that was a long journey to answer your question, but I didn't set out to write this book. Like this book kind of found me.
Hmm. Well, I think that's great. And I love, you do talk about that in the introduction, and I love the origins of this book because of that, it started as, you know, just a simple do's and don'ts from the rich narratives you were getting from your interviews from students, directly from students. And it's just so listeners know, and hopefully they will pick up the book. It's a small book. It's not really overwhelming at all. And there's a nice introduction, and then a week by week, I think 16 maybe weeks, 15 weeks. And 15. And each chapter has quotes from students that relate to the strategy that Lisa lays out and then the rationale for the strategy. So it's very readable. And you could, you know, pull it off your shelf and scan that week in a few minutes and get some great ideas. So I know sometimes people feel like a book is such a commitment, and this is really user-friendly in that way. So I want to make sure listeners understand that and know that. And you kind of spoke to this, so we don't have to linger too long here, but I do want to make sure to say that or ask about this, because one of the first things you do in the book is to address the reality and research on high school preparation for first generation versus continuing generation students. Mm-hmm. And talking about high school preparation moves the conversation of student success from students' abilities to their academic skill sets. And while faculty may understand this distinction, we hope, students don't always experience it this way. So would you talk to us a bit about why naming this distinction was so important to the conversation and to the book that you really, it's like the first thing you do in the book?
Yeah, well, it's interesting to hear you frame it as students really not understanding this distinction. I think that's probably true, but I've thought a lot less about that, to be honest, and a lot more about the faculty perspective. And this is something, you know, that was somewhat true for me, but also, you know, I'm a sociologist of education, and it shows up again and again in research on concepts like cultural capital. But this idea, this sense that when you're standing up in front of the room, and there are some students who know the answer when you ask a question, who volunteer a sophisticated comment that speaks directly to the heart of the issues you're discussing in class, or can really nail the details of the maybe laboratory experiment that you've got going on. From our perspective in the front of the room, that can feel like smarts. That can seem like, oh, she's really bright. She's really good at this. Boy, she really knows what she's doing. And it can feel like she's got the intellectual capacity or she's got the smarts for this. And someone who struggles and is a little slower and can't quite get the details right and fumbles with the nuances of the concept, that can feel like maybe they don't have the aptitude for this or the intellectual pieces put together. And that is just not the way to approach recognizing who our students are in the classroom and where they're at and what they bring, right? All of that is really due to how much practice students have had over their lives at critical thinking, at writing up a lab report, at raising your hand after you fully articulated a question in your mind and knowing what a sophisticated sounding question sounds like before you even raise your hand to contribute such a thing to a discussion. These are skills that are learned and practiced, and some of us have been practicing them our whole lives long. our whole lives long. Some of us, and others of us just haven't, right? Some mm-hmm. students arrive at college with very little critical thinking practice, and they get there over their college trajectory, but they maybe, yeah.
They may take more time. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. They're maybe not impressing their professor out of the gate in the first weeks, months, couple of years of college.
Well, and just real quick to kind of comment on that, I think, you know, sometimes we can do a better job, I think, of helping. I mean, a lot of times I think we could do a better job of showing how you actually do that critical thinking work, and step by step what that looks like, and, yep. and scaffolding for that in our classes. I have a background in student success, and I'll probably talk about that a few times in this because I loved your book because of my background in student success. And I worked out of, when I was at the University of Kentucky, I worked and taught out of their academic support unit. And I taught courses specifically, problem-based courses specifically targeting, you know, students on academic probation. And we did that. We scaffolded for how do you critically read? How do you critically think? How do you critically engage this college level material? And it's just something that oftentimes isn't taught. And so if students haven't had that prior to college, they really, you know, even in college, sometimes they're not taught how to do that. And so they're trying to figure that out as they go. And that does take a lot more time on your own, and you're watching other people. And I say that, you know, my question of saying sometimes students don't experience it that way. They don't interpret it that way because, you know, they will probably interpret it a lot of students will interpret that it's me. It is my innate ability and my intelligence level versus someone else's, not so much my preparation and my practice and the skill set that, and when we talk about it as a skill, a skill can be learned and a skill can be practiced. It's not about innate ability at all. So I just wanted to make sure we start there because you started there. And I think it's a really important distinction in this conversation around student success. And is going to continue to be really important as we, you know, are living through this pandemic and very, you know, challenging end of high school experiences for a lot of students. So I think this is even more salient and has been salient for a long time, but is even more so moving forward. I want to read a quote, and it's a little lengthy, but I just, I think it's really important. And again, it's from the beginning of the book. And then I was hoping maybe you could just, you know, comment on it. So also very on in the introduction, you describe the many strengths of first generation students, and you did that in this book and you do it even more so in the College Belonging book. But from there you state, quote, "Our goal should not be to make first generation students become more like their continuing generation counterparts exactly. Rather, our goal should be to help transform the university, our own classrooms, if not beyond, to attend to the wider set of educational histories, adult responsibilities, and cultural sensibilities of our entire student body, rather than the narrower set of lived experiences that many of us imagine that a, quote, typical college student has had," end quote. So could you talk about that a little bit more about, we're not necessarily trying to replicate in all ways, you know, continuing making first gen into continuing gen, because they do come with their own distinct set of strengths.
Oh yeah. Thanks for that. Let's start with something like assignments, right? The way that we design our courses and our syllabi and the rhythm of the semester, the norms of higher education teaching, the way we all are taught to teach, to create a syllabus, all of those things. Let's just talk about one example. So due dates, right? I have an assignment. It's due on this particular day at this particular hour. If it's not turned in by that time, it's late. And it's a little bit up to the professor about how organized or in it, organized, that was a judgmental way to say that. How far in advance to give the assignment prompt to the students, how detailed that assignment prompt or instructions should be, right? All of that's based on the professor's ideas about what they want to do. Also like what the grading criteria, all of these things, right? So if I'm a student who does not fit this typical mold, so what I'm driving at here is everything that we do, including down to like this one detail of an assignment due date, is based on a set of assumptions about who our students are and what their lives are like. And those assumptions are really in much of higher ed, not all of higher ed, but much of higher ed, they're really based on this idea of the traditional student. This mm-hmm. is a young person without a lot of commitments, like domestic commitments of their own, right? In fact, we encourage them to live on campus in dormitories where they have no domestic commitments other than getting along with a roommate. And it's this person who is free from work obligations, who is free from economic stress. And as my continuing generation students in my research study describe it, they say things like, my only job right now is to focus on school. School is my job right now. My parents keep telling me that the thing I need to do is to focus on school, right? That, and they're free as much as possible from all other demands on them. So if I'm a person who is working two, maybe three part-time jobs in order to make ends meet, who has a deep, committed relationship with my family that includes obligations to maybe it's my job to pick up my cousin from after school care 3 days a week. And I need to do that, right? It doesn't matter that I'm in college and I got my own college thing going on. I'm still living up to and honoring family obligations and commitments that are very meaningful to me. I'm also working for money because I'm not free from economic concerns. And something like a due date that is so solid and fixed and has to be turned in by this one, like there's no flex, that does not, these rigid due dates, right, for an example, are not designed with assumptions about me as a student in mind. And these are things that we could change, right? Mm-hmm. I can have an assignment and I could have a series of days and you could pick the day that it's due. Or I don't know, right? We could be creative. But yeah. I hope that deep dive into one example helps clarify what I'm talking about. Like we have built the university and every part of it assuming that students are one type of social and economic position.
Yes. And undergrad, especially especially. I teach in a graduate program and an online graduate program. And I very much am aware that my students, and I just wrapped up and I had students, you know, that they have those domestic responsibilities they are, you know, sometimes coming back for second careers or whatever. Mm-hmm. So, you know, for the gamut from a mother of two, you know, school-aged kids who are trying to remote learn and she's working to a woman who's taking care of her 95-year-old mother, a caregiver, full-time caregiver to a 95-year-old. So, you know, I feel like sometimes depending on the structure of the program or the level, we might be a bit more forgiving, but for traditional undergrad, a lot of times, like you said, we kind of have this typical college student idea in mind. And the flexibility isn't always there or the understanding. And what does that mean in terms of giving one day or a day or two an option, that doesn't reflect their level of understanding, you know, but it helps them be able to demonstrate their level of understanding more. So that's a great example. Thank you. I wanted to highlight too, one of the strategies that you offer. It's strategy 8 that I really liked because, as I mentioned, that I have worked with students who are in academic jeopardy, and lots of I've worked in with programs specifically designed for first gen students, and so I this book really resonated with me, and so this strategy in particular, strategy 8, is the mini midterm in week 2. I loved this strategy because of all this work that I have done with students, and I know sometimes how we know how that goes, and you name it very clearly in the book that, you know, a lot of times it's not till midterm that students really understand, you know, what the test experience is like. And then if they have 2 weeks after the actual midterm to get their grade back, I mean, you are 8 to 10 weeks into that semester and there's not a whole lot sometimes that can be salvaged. And so, this strategy and so many others in the book, I feel like we're spot on in terms of how really practical ideas for addressing some of these challenges for students. And some of these are not just first gen student challenges. These can definitely be continuing gen as well. Just, you know, in first year first-year student experiences. So could you talk a little bit, maybe explain that strategy a little bit for listeners and why that's so important?
Yeah, thank you. You summed up well the rationale behind it. Students, so many students that I interviewed had just a disastrous midterm or maybe multiple disastrous midterms in their first semester or even their second semester. And exactly as you said, it wasn't until they got that F or that D back, which is heartbreaking and emotionally traumatic. It wasn't until that point that they realized, oh my gosh, I'm not studying properly for this class. I guess I'm not taking the right notes. I guess I'm not preparing right for the exam. You know, I need to make some changes. But it's this traumatic experience. And as you said, it's often very late in the game that a midterm happens, and then the midterm is graded and returned. That takes even more time. So it's really late in the game. And we can just help resolve that problem by giving a teeny tiny version of your real exam, right? Whatever your exam in, mine are open-ended questions, but timed in class for my introductory class. So where on a midterm, I might have five, on the mini midterm, I have one. And I recommend that we give the mini midterm in week two, maybe the beginning of week three, but really early so that students, there's not a lot of material that's been covered. They don't have to study for hours and hours for this, but they can get a real honest, clear look at what kinds of questions I ask, what I'm looking for in the answers, and also, were they taking the right kinds of notes? Were they underlining the right kinds of things in the text? Were they able to glean from my lecture slides? Like, were they putting all the pieces together from that week or two of content in a way that allowed them to succeed on my exam? And if not, let's make some changes. Let's figure this out. And students have expressed so much gratitude for the mini midterm. I mean, I had never done that before. It was listening to students in my interviews talk about their disastrous, heartbreaking. I mean, so many students break down in tears talking about this terrible F or D, or for some students, even a C. But heartbreaking moments for them.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Well, and it's devastating for their, I use this term a lot for students, their academic self-efficacy. I mean, just this idea that, like what you're saying, like, which I think is akin to some level of the academic belonging that you write about, is this, I can do this. Like my academic self-efficacy, I have the ability to do this. I can do this. It's just so deflating, deflating to that. And then not having a lot of time to recover and redeem yourself in that same course or same semester. And so that's why I did. I love that. I think that's such a great, great strategy to mitigate this very common reality for both first gen. I mean, just for first year students in general. And honestly, I'd say going through, because one of the things we do each semester, right? I learned this or I figured this out in college, is the first exam was always the hardest because you're figuring out how this professor gives exams and what they're looking for and what they're, you know, especially if it's not very clearly stated. And you do that every semester or every time you have a new professor. So that's not just a first year student thing. That's, you know, continuing. So if every professor did that, then that would really help, you know, help students get acclimated to the course, to your style of teaching, to what you're looking for, that sort of thing. And I think it's just a great strategy. I wanted to talk also about strategy six that you talked about start practicing new habits of speech. And you encourage faculty to help students make the transition to college academics by talking about campus resources in positive ways rather than as a last resort. And again, I was very drawn to this strategy because I did do student success work and in an academic support unit. And this aligns with, like, this idea aligns very much with what our colleagues across campus in student support services are trying to do. And so, you know, having faculty change their language, having faculty use positive language to support these programs is huge. So the example from my background is when I worked in that unit, our signature program was a drop-in group peer tutoring program, and it was huge. It was the main service for the whole university, and it targeted first and second year students. And we used to tell students all the time out of our unit, come often and come early. Come early, come often, we would say, because we knew that students who used that service had higher GPAs than those who didn't, based on our data. And that was across the academic spectrum. So students who were already A students were even stronger students after using that service. And students who were C's and D students were stronger students. So it didn't just serve students who were struggling. It served all students well. And that was based on the data at that particular university at that time. But I'm going to make a leap and say, you know, if you have a strong support service like that, that would be true for most institutions. So I appreciate that you address the ways that faculty can support both the student in doing that and also our colleagues across campus who are working in student support services just by changing our language, just by changing the way that we talk about these things, and encouraging everyone to use them, that this is what successful students do. They use these, they partake of these free services that are available. And it's not just if you're struggling or failing or, you know, trying to eliminate that stigma attached to student support services sometimes. Have you found that these strategies have helped build bridges with your colleagues across campus?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I can't say that my strategies were the impulse behind some of the connections that have been built in recent years, but it's definitely part. I hope that it's part of the conversation. So for example, we have a student support services, the SSS TRIO program on campus. And the last few years, they've been inviting faculty to hold one of their office hours in the SSS lounge. And that's been a really, I did it. It's a really fun example of how some of these partnerships and collaborations with colleagues across campus can happen with faculty. But I really appreciate you pointing out this shift in language piece, because I'm not sure that faculty are always, myself included, always aware of just the way that we phrase something can make a big difference in how students mm-hmm. receive it. But also throughout the book, the heart of many of these strategies is to communicate a clear sense to our students that we care about their success. We're in their corner. We haven't given up on them, right? Mm-hmm. We believe in them. They've got what it takes. Now, not everyone is going to pass the class. Not everyone is going to get an A for sure. But to just communicate the sense that I believe in you, I guess.
I'm rooting for you,
yeah,
right?
I'm rooting for you. Yeah. And one of the, you pointed to a really easy way to do that. It's to not say, hey, come see me in office hours if you have any questions. Not say, there's a tutoring center, you know, right down the hall here if you need help. That's not the, but to say instead, why don't you come into my office hour and just sit there and do your homework or do it in the hall right outside. And then I'm right there. I'm right there if you have a question. Go in the tutoring, like maybe you don't know if you have questions, just take your homework in there. Take your homework into the tutoring center, do it in there. And then all you have to do is raise your hand if you've got a question or a stumbling block that you could use a little help with.
Exactly. Exactly. So I wanted to kind of, in the next few questions, I wanted to highlight a couple strategies, one from the beginning of a term and then middle and towards the end. So your strategy for week one is to introduce yourself. which we all know to do, right? We all know to do that. But your twist is not to introduce your professional self. You suggest introducing yourself as a person to your students. Can you talk a bit more about that strategy and why that's an effective strategy?
Yeah. And can I tell you that this is something that I did very poorly and awkwardly before this research project, that hearing students talk about this stuff changed my ways. So yes, I used to very awkwardly introduce myself and what I researched. And, you know, I had this little awkward professional bio that I would give at the start of class, and then I would just move on into the content, because that's where I felt more, I don't know, at ease or confident, or I don't know what it was that was making me so awkward. But what I learned from these interviews, and what's driving several of the strategies, including this one, number one, is that students told me over and over again in different kinds of ways how much they appreciate it when a professor bothers to share a detail or two about their lives with them, or with the whole class, or, you know, maybe with them one-on-one in a office hour or hallway conversation, but how meaningful it is to feel like the professor isn't too busy for them, isn't too important for them, isn't too, have other things going on. Because that's how many students feel, first gen students especially, but also lots of continuing gen students felt like they didn't want to bother their professor. They didn't want to, she's got so much, you know, she's got so many things, but she's so busy. I'm not going to go ask a question. They feel this sense of intimidation and a big distance and gap between the authority. And it's often out of deep respect. The student doesn't engage with the professor at all because out of respect for their time and their status and their, the importance of the important seemingness of the faculty member. Okay. So in all kinds of ways, students told me that when I, as a faculty member, bother to share a detail about my life, it makes the student feel seen. It makes the student feel, so it's all about belonging, right? It makes them feel like, wow, I'm an important enough person. Yes. For her to share something with. And they love it when we do it in class. They want to know, what's the name of my dog? They want to know, what did I do this weekend? They want to know, what's my favorite ice cream flavor, right? Like, I don't need to share deeply personal things to connect with them. They're happy to connect on just like, you know, do I have kids? Do I live in the same town as the college? Do I these things. So starting off on day one is a strategy I recommend to just kick this off and to practice it in all kinds of ways. Later in the book, I suggest, not too much later, I think it's week two or something, that I suggest sharing some stories about your own college days, right? Mm-hmm. As an undergraduate. Mm-hmm. And later in the book, I suggest sharing some stories of woe from your college days, because students are going through hardships and heartbreaks and failures and rejections. And it's nice to hear that a professor, someone that they admire so much, also had some, you know, bad grades in college, or a bad roommate in college, or a bad decision in college. They relish this. It builds belonging.
Thank you. And so to kind of speed up into week eight, your suggestion is to collect mid-semester feedback with KQS cards, as you call them. Can you sort of elaborate on what that is and what those cards are and how you use those?
Yeah, KQS. So I didn't invent this. I learned it from off the internet. And I use, as recommended by this wonderful internet source, I use index cards when we were in person, because they're small. There's not a lot of real estate. Students really have to, you know, decide what they want to focus on to give you feedback on. But the K is for keep. So I ask them to tell me one thing that they want me to keep doing. And then the Q is for quit. So one thing they want me to quit doing, and the S is for start. One thing they want me to start doing. So I hand out these cards. I put KQS up on the board. I give them a few minutes. It's anonymous. I collect them back. Now, I have to be willing to actually make some changes if enough students suggest the same, you know, the same kind of thing, but also I'm in control of whether or not it's pedagogically sound to make some of the changes that they recommend, which is not always true, all of that. But the point of collecting mid-semester feedback is partly so that I can improve my class to better meet the needs of my students, to better fit with, to hear about things that I just might not know are problems or struggle points for them, and also to hear about things that they really love so I can be sure not to squeeze those things out if I feel short on time toward the end of the semester. So it's to improve the class, of course, but what it also does is it shows students that I don't think I'm perfect. I don't think this class is perfect, and I'm willing to make some changes to improve it. And that's exactly the same thing that we're asking students to do. We're demanding that they do every time we give them back a graded assignment or a test. We're saying, here's what you did well. Here's what you did wrong. Work on it. Or maybe disastrous grade, right? You're doing a lot of things wrong. You better make some real changes to be able to pass this class. And to just reciprocate that one day, one for 5 minutes in the middle of the semester somewhere. But then, of course, to come back with the results and share out the results from the KQSs and to share out whatever small or big changes you're willing to make.
Well, I also loved this strategy because, and I'm sure, I think you do talk about this in the book, is that, you know, we, as faculty, we get those end of, you know, our course evaluations, of course, and then, but that only benefits the next term, the next group of students. And I just did a major revision to one of the classes I teach, and everybody loved it. And I feel like I want to email back to all the students in the last term and say, whoever suggested this, everybody's loving it. Thank you so much. And so doing this midterm gives you a chance to actually do changes in real time that benefit that group of students for that course. And that was one of the reasons I loved it too, as a great strategy. So you kind of already alluded to this, but I did want to hit on real quick because I also was really drawn to this strategy. It's in week 14, and you did allude to this already, this idea of a CV of failures, sharing a CV of failures in class to model learning from our failures. And I love this as well, because again, I have a strong background in working with students who have been in jeopardy or are coming off of academic probation, who are in academic jeopardy and who are struggling to figure out, do I fit? Should I be here? Why am I here? And I think it's a human thing. I think students definitely do it, especially when they're looking at someone who's successful. And if you're teaching a course in your faculty, like, you're successful in what you do, you've made it that far. And so I think we have this tendency to kind of think, they never made a mistake, right? I mean, we know that's probably not true, but you tend to feel like you're the only one. So then, you know, seeing on paper a whole CV, not of all of my successes, not a resume of all the great things I've done, but of all of the missteps or things that didn't work out as I planned. And then being able to even talk through how those were not even failures if we learned from them. I try to teach my 8-year-old son this all the time. There's really not it's not a failure if you learn from this. If there's a lesson, then it's a complete success, you know, in a different way. And so I think, you know, doing that with college students is so important, especially as you said, it's trying to figure out, do I fit here? And if I've just made some mistakes and so can you talk about that and why that's important in week 14?
Yeah. Toward the end of the semester, students are, especially the, right, I was interviewing first year students in particular. So especially for students who are newer to college, but I think it's true for everyone. The end of the semester, we're exhausted. All of us are. And for students who are struggling to kind of pull a grade up from disaster in a class or two, right? There's an extra element of stress. Everything is just kind of snowballing. And so I think it's particularly useful toward the end of the semester to engage in a lot of small conversations or small activities that just acknowledge how rough it is in so many aspects of our lives at the end of the academic semester. And the CV of failure. So I think it's a good time toward the end, because it's also a morale booster moving into finals, right? To get to get a little boost of encouragement and energy moving into finals. But it's bigger, right? It's not just about this one class. Just like you were saying, it's this bigger life picture of us as faculty members normalizing failures, normalizing the struggle. Exactly like you were saying, students feel like they're the only one, that they're all, it's so lonely to be struggling. It's such a lonely place to be. And to hear or to read your own faculty members' big long list of things that did not go their way. And to see, you know, look, she made it. Look at her. Yeah. You know, she ended up successful in life despite all of these things. It's very validating. But I also want to say one more thing about this activity. When I was first doing those weekly email blasts to my own campus, this idea was there, right? At this same time in the semester, a CV of failures, but the examples that I gave were all for examples from online, right? I didn't invent this idea. It's out there. It's a wonderful, well-established idea, the CV of failures. I was not brave enough to write my own. And a colleague of mine, his name's Drew Talley, he's wonderful. He sent me an email with the CV of failures he wrote about himself that he shared with his students, and he thought that I might get a kick out of it, so he shared his with me. And I just laughed at myself. I thought, if Drew Talley can write this up so easily and be so light about it that he's sharing it around, I can write one of my own. And I wrote one, and I was not brave enough to share it with my students. It took through this process of deciding that I would try to publish all these things into this book. And I had to give myself a pep talk to be able to say, okay, you're going to put your own example in that book. You're not going to put a bunch of links to other people's stuff. And so I'm just sharing this story because none of this book came from a place of me feeling like, oh, I know how people should be teaching their classes and I'm good at this. I should share my wisdom with other people about how to be an excellent relationship builder with students. No, I wrote this book with a great deal of humility because I was not doing these things well. And the conversations with students and these interviews helped me learn what I could do better. And the CV of failures was a challenge for me, but it's in there and everyone can read it.
It is. And it's brave. It's very counterintuitive to how we are trained our entire lives. So in fairness, it is probably not just you. It is very counterintuitive to, you know, how we are, especially in the academy, I feel like. So, but I really appreciated it. And I loved that it was yours. When I read that, I was like, oh, this is hers. This is great. And again, that we, you know, model for students what we're talking about, that we can live it and model it. We have just a few minutes left for a couple other questions. So I know from doing student success work myself that sometimes there can be pushback from faculty who feel it's not their job to teach students how to study or how to spend their class time or spend their class time on success like oriented strategies, right? I know that perspective is out there. Have you received any feedback along those lines or pushback like that? And what is your response to that kind of a mindset? What would you say to that kind of a mindset?
Yeah, I sure have received that. I must say on my own campus more than anywhere else. And that's probably just because, you know, I'm a known entity there. And so people might feel more comfortable. I don't know. Mm-hmm. When I'm invited to other campuses, the folks who come to the workshop or the talk almost never challenge me in this way. But that's okay. Maybe it's they're being polite to the guest.
Well, it's also self-selection probably.
I think that has something to do with it. So what's my response? My response is, okay. I mean, if you're sure that building relationships is absolutely outside your job description, this might not be very helpful, but like, I don't know where to go with that, but it is. Part of teaching is the part where you have students that you are reaching with your knowledge and with the, you know, skills building that you're trying to create for them. And to me, I relationships with students is just part and parcel. Now, we don't have to be best friends. That's not where I'm going with this. But if we can think about our students in the same way that we think about people in our family or in our neighborhood that we care about, and just, what am I trying to say? Just recognize that a little bit of encouragement, 2 minutes sort of lingering around the classroom at the end, looking available so that someone might, you know, feel brave enough to come up and ask us a question. Those kinds of small things build a sense of confidence and safety and encouragement for students in ways that I think it is part of our job.
Well, I love that I asked you about student, like when you get pushback on student success, like success oriented strategies, and you went right to relationship building because it's one in the same in a lot of ways. And I love that, that because I think students are more receptive to hear and to like take a deep breath and sink into their seat a little bit more comfortably when they feel comfortable in that classroom and in that space, they can kind of relax and ease into the learning. And that comes out of feeling connected and that you belong and in relationship. And so, you know, those two pieces of being success, you know, intentionally focusing on student success and strategies to do that and the relationship building are intricately connected. And so I kind of love that you went the relationship route, and I agree. So, so thank you for that. Kind of towards the last question here, by the time this episode airs or for this summer, and we're recording at the end of May, 2021, or for those who are listening in after the semester has begun, whenever they find this episode, faculty will have already planned their syllabi. But this, you know, I love this book because there are so many effective strategies that can be implemented as the semester is beginning or already underway. So you can kind of get the book and pull it off the shelf and just, you know, find some great things. So what are your suggestions for where faculty should start, or maybe your kind of like top three strategies for getting started? What would be some of those that you would recommend if someone's feeling like, well, I'm not sure where to begin with this, or they don't want to dive in and do the whole thing? Do you have recommendations for where to begin?
Yeah, I would say that mini midterm, if you've got the wherewithal or the time to be able to build that into your syllabus, into your timing, working in a mini midterm, or just do a mock one with the for no points or something. If you've, you know, come to the idea after your syllabus is set in stone. But then also I would pick maybe just 3 days in the semester, just three, and you don't even have to do the activity or the strategies on the same week that I recommend them. Of course, you know, feel free, but find a strategy that fits with the way that you like to interact with students, your own teaching style. And maybe it's, like sharing stress relieving routine. So pick a day and give yourself 5 minutes in class to just talk a little bit about how you manage stress and give your students some tips, or invite them along on a hike or something, if you want to go that far. And then, you know, so start small, right? Pick three, browse the book, just flip through the pages and open one and see if you like that thing, whatever's on that page. And mark your calendar somewhere to be able to just set aside 5 minutes or 10 minutes to implement it.
Great. Final question. What would you say has surprised you the most as you've done this work with this book?
Wow, that's a question. Nothing is immediately popping to my mind.
Maybe the most enjoyable aspect about writing this book and doing this work.
Okay. These interviews with students, articulating their ideas into concrete strategies, has given me permission to take time to prioritize some of these, what I would think of before as small conversations or things that might take place outside of the classroom. But again, like I was just describing, to carve out 5 minutes and say, tomorrow I'm doing this, right? I don't care how much conversation we need to have about the content. I'm taking 5, maybe 10 minutes to just prioritize this. And it's really given me, again, permission to prioritize thinking about my students, doing a little connecting with them in the class, not waiting for office hours, not waiting to bump into them in the halls. I think I struggled before to really be able to say, this is important enough to quote unquote take away from class time. Because now I fully recognize it is not taking away from class time. It is allowing students to feel good in a way that allows them to really be present for the lecture, the discussion, the activity, the tasks in class. It allows them to really be open and like learn and absorb more. It's absolutely not a zero-sum game with the minutes of class time and whether we devote them to me lecturing or having discussions like these.
Mm. Great. Thank you so much, Lisa. Thank you for being on the show again and for sharing with us about this book. It's been great having you.
Thank you. I am just delighted that this work has resonated with you and with other folks who may be hearing about it for the first time. I hope it resonates with them too.
Thank you. Thank you. We've been talking with Lisa Nunn about her new book, 33 Simple Strategies for Faculty, a week-by-week resource for teaching first-year and first-generation students. I'm Dr. Dana Malone. This is The Academic Life, and you've been listening to New Books Network. Please join us again.